And our very special guest tonight, great storyteller, Robert Schneck. And we're going to be back with him to talk more about some bizarre things, including Ouija boards on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, before we get into other material in the book, did you come across any Jersey Devil stories while you were doing all your research?
Well, as a native of New Jersey, of course, I grew up with the Jersey Devil. But there have been a few really good books written on that in the last few years, so I didn't feel I could add to it.
Okay, let's talk about the mummified heads found in Wyoming.
Okay, they were the mummified heads of cannibal midgets. And they were found in eagles' nests in Wyoming in 1932, and that's one of those things that when you come across it, you say, "Now there's got to be a story behind this." And the story actually was a strange but true classic. It was one of the first strange but true stories I ever read, and almost everybody knows it who's ever read Stranger Than Science, and that's the story of Pedro, the mountain mummy. A pair of prospectors in 1932 were up in the Pedro Mountains in Wyoming outside of Casper, and they were doing something called gophering, which is just setting off charges in the rock bed to try to dislodge some stone and see if they can find any veins of anything precious. Well, they were doing this, and they uncovered a cave that had been tightly sealed with stones. It was a tiny cave, maybe 15 feet deep and too low to stand up in. One of them went in, kept going back, and he found a stone shelf that had a tiny little mummified man on it. Well, this was interesting. So they brought it back to Casper. They tried to, one of them kept it, and he tried to sell it to the state of Wyoming, but this was the depth of the Depression. And they didn't, and there was no provenance. That is to say, the miner couldn't say where he found it, which was a little suspicious. Anyway, after being displayed in a drugstore and at state fairs, this tiny little man ended up in the being owned by a man called Ivan Goodman, who owned a used car. He was a used car dealer and an insurance salesman in Casper, and somehow he convinced Sunoco Three Star Radio, which was a show at the time, to sponsor him. I'm assuming this. I've never found any actual record of that, but to let him go to New York to have the little man examined at the Museum of Natural History. And the head of the anthropology department, I was the chair of it, I believe, was Harry Shapiro, who was very interested in the relationship between height and nutrition and environment. So he thought, well, if this really is a tiny little pygmy mummy, this will help my work. Well, Harry Shapiro, he did a good job of what they could do back in the 1950s, which we're about up to the 50s now. He x-rayed it and examined it, and he said it was the remains of an anencephalic infant. That is to say, an infant that had a birth defect where the brain didn't form and the top of the head didn't form.
Jeez.
And it left it looking like an old man with kind of protruding eyes, and being placed in this cave had left it very wrinkled, so it looked like a little old man. It was then taken to the Field Museum in Chicago, where a group of very distinguished scientists looked it over and came to the same conclusion. Well, Ivan Goodman brought it back to Casper, and he wrote this kind of big flyer saying it had been examined by scientists and claimed that it was the remains of an ancient creature prepared the way the mummies of Egypt had been prepared. He was a bit of a showman. He had a bit of the P.T. Barnum,
yeah,
in him. Well, he was in New York, and he became very sick. And something happened to the mummy, which I refer to as Pedro. I think a lot of people do, after the mountain where it was found. Goodman eventually died in Denver. And the mummy, the little man, Pedro, hasn't been seen since. And there are some stories about that he might be in Florida. Goodman claims that there was a very elaborate con job set up where someone claimed to be a wealthy man and invited him to his penthouse and said he wanted to examine, you know, asked him to leave the little mummy there. And then when Goodman returned for it, the penthouse had vanished. I mean, it was a real weird story. And for a man like Goodman, who let's just say he was a man who liked to tell a good story. And I don't know what happened to it. No one does. His family still wants it, understandably. Well, there a lot of strange stories began circulating about Pedro. I mean, there is one story that claimed he had serrated teeth, which suggested he was some kind of a vampire or a cannibal. And there was another story. I found an eyewitness account that I don't think has ever appeared in print before. And that was by a man who still lives in Casper, who knew Ivan Goodman. In fact, he had a lot of good things to say about him. And when he was a kid, Goodman invited him into his office to see the little man. And when Goodman held it near a light and it got warm, it would apparently drip some kind of a red fluid. Now, no one else has ever seen this, but he said that he was there and he said it happened.
You mean like blood?
Well, he couldn't say. It was a red fluid. And all of this goes back to something very interesting, which is a tradition among the Arapaho and the Shoshone that there is a race of tiny cannibal pygmies that live in the mountains in that area. In fact, there were some spots that they would avoid, supposedly, because these little pygmies would attack them and eat them. Now, all the pygmies were supposedly wiped out. They were driven into a canyon, and the grass was set on fire, and the pygmies killed. But apparently, there are a few stragglers that survive. And there's one story that of a Shoshone, I think, who saved one of these little pygmies who was being attacked by an eagle that was trying to fly off with him and eat him. Now we're going to tie it into the eagle's nests here. 1932 was also the year that these little, like I said, pygmy heads began to be found in eagle's nests. Now, these heads are, well, at least one of them is in the possession of the University of Wyoming, I think, and it's made out of what is either a gourd, it's made out of some kind of vegetable material, maybe a potato, something like those little shrunken heads made out of apples.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it appears that there was a little industry of people who were making fake mummified cannibal heads and claiming that they were found in cannibals in eagles' nests based on the Arapaho and Shoshone folklore, and that they were selling them to tourists and people like that. Because again, 1932 was the worst year of the Depression. So I suspect that there were a lot of people poking around in caves and finding one or two of these mummies, because there are other stories about little mummies just like Pedro being found at the same time. In fact, George Gill, who is at the University of Wyoming, he did one of those programs like Unsolved Mysteries or something, and a woman contacted him because she had one. And he was able to give it a complete examination. I mean, using technology that didn't exist back in the 1950s when Pedro disappeared. And he hasn't released his findings yet, but apparently they're very interesting. And these little mummies are – he only gave me a clue here and there. I mean, it's his research, and I can't spoil it. But these things are old, and they may not be Native American. So – I'll just leave it at that, because it's up to him to pronounce to say what he found, and I don't want to start any rumors or gossip that are wrong.
What was the Indian folklore about these things?
Well, it was that there was a race of tiny cannibal midgets that lived in the woods, that lived in the mountains, rather, and that they would attack people who went out hunting by themselves.
But that eagles would swoop down and take them?
And that eagles would feed on them. And you know, something else that's very interesting. I was reading a book recently that talked about the town baby, which was the first, I think, Australopithecus skull ever found. And the marks on its skull show that it was probably killed by an eagle.
That's amazing.
It's got these deep claw marks in its head, and it has its jaw. And apparently one of the things that distinguishes eagle, victims of big carnivorous birds, their jaws stay attached, unlike things like hyenas or bears that just tear everything to shreds.
Ever stumble across Thunderbird stories?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, lots of Thunderbird stories. In fact, a friend of mine, he collects them from Pennsylvania, the Black Forest of Pennsylvania, where there are supposedly giant birds appearing. You know, giant birds, Mothman, call it what you want. Sometimes people see big things in the sky. I mean, there were pterodactyl sightings in Texas back in the 1970s.
In the 70s?
Yeah, I think around 72, people started seeing pterodactyls in Texas. In fact, a group of school teachers, I think, saw them.
You remember that story about the large bird that swooped down, was picking up a kid, and I guess the mom was hitting the bird with a broom so it would drop him?
Yeah, I think Lauren Coleman's brother investigated that story. I think it was Illinois, and also back in the 70s. So, you know, sometimes things happen, and when the human race was much tinier and more wild, that was one other thing we had to watch out for. Saber-toothed tigers were one thing, but you also had to look up because you never knew it was going to be swooping down with claws.
So true. Of all the mysteries in the book, which ones would you like to unravel?
Well, of all of them, the one that I think really needs to be solved because it involves families that lost somebody, and it's the disappearance of five young men from Newark simultaneously. 1978.
Five separate episodes?
No, they were all together.
Okay.
They knew each other. They had played basketball that afternoon, and a man named Lee Evans, whose nickname was Big Man, he hired them to move boxes in Irvington. This was all taking place in Newark. They lived in Newark.
All right.
And he hired them to move boxes in Irvington. So they got into his car, and the day was spent moving boxes and doing various things, and around 11 o'clock or so, Lee Evans dropped them off at the corner of Clinton Avenue and Fabian Place in Newark. Now, he dropped them off. Witnesses saw that. And to quote one of the detectives, Charles Conti, one of the men who investigated this case, there was a 20 to 40 minute period when they were seen apart. Two of them together, then three of them together. So that they broke up into two groups, and sometime before midnight, all five of them vanished. They have never been seen since, and there's only been one clue, and that was that a member of one of their families received a phone call saying that the boys had been arrested in Washington, D.C., somehow related to the robbery of a truck, or the truck heist, I think was what they said. And that was it.
Would these kids have robbed the truck?
Well, they were never arrested.
Yeah.
They said they were at the boys' home or something down in Washington, D.C., but it never happened. The phone call, however, did come from Washington, D.C. It came from Union Station, the old railroad station in Washington, D.C., and after a while, the police didn't realize at the time that these five had disappeared. They had gotten missing persons reports, but they hadn't realized that all five of them had vanished together. And they started looking, and they spent years digging into this story because, I mean, five families have lost their sons, their nephews. All these five of them just vanished, and without leaving a trace behind, nothing. So the police looked into everything. They looked to see if they were among the victims of the Atlanta child murders. They looked to see if they were among the victims of the Jonestown massacre in Guyana. They even checked to see if any of them had been the victims of Jeffrey Dahmer in Milwaukee, but nothing. Their social security numbers were never used. They never applied for driver's licenses anywhere else in the United States. It's like they were erased. And one of the things I find so strange about this story is how few people have ever even heard of it. It's outside of Newark, New Jersey, it seems to be almost unknown.
How many bizarre stories do you think are occurring all the time?
I think that we hear the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are so many things to prevent people from telling these stories. No one wants to look like a loony. No one wants to be laughed at. I mean, think about it. If you went in to get a bank loan, would you tell the guy about the flying saucer you saw last night?
Well, I probably would.
Well, I would too, but, you know, you probably have a better credit rating than me. There are a lot of things to keep us from telling these stories, but the internet has changed a lot of that. I mean, there are so many websites dedicated to nothing but people telling their ghost story, people telling their Bigfoot encounter, people telling their UFO sighting, that I think a lot more of it is turning up in print.
And how many do you think are true?
I can't answer that. No one can. I mean, there are people who make things up just for the fun of it. There are people who are crazy. I mean, they think things have happened that haven't happened. There are people who just enjoy hoaxing, and they can be a problem. But even, you know, what if something strange happens to them? No one will ever believe it.
Wasn't P.T. Barnum one of those kinds of people? He loved to do this. He was a joker.
P.T. Barnum liked to make money.
Yes.
And
first and foremost.
First and foremost. He loved to make money, and he loved to make money by entertaining people and having a good time. And you didn't go to him for reliable truths. You went to him for entertainment.
How would you compare P.T. Barnum to Robert Ripley?
You know, that's interesting, actually, because both of them, for their times, were important people in this whole idea of paranormal literature. You know, there's a whole literature of sideshow attractions, almost all of it made up, about, you know, this person, this wild man was caught in Borneo, 20 porters died, he had to be put into a crate this is a whole literature of that. And Robert Ripley's column began, I think, a year after Charles Fort published his Book of the Damned, which is the one that really got things started. But in the modern world, you know, the first real UFO stories appear in the Book of the Damned. There are, of course, all the airship stories from the 1890s, not to mention dozens of other things. But Ripley was the great popularizer. He's the one that made people aware of all this stuff that was going on. Plus, let's face it, those pictures were just pretty damn cool. I can still remember pictures that I saw in Ripley books that I saw 30 years ago, particularly the man who hollowed out the hole in his head and put the candle in it.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember that. Talk about bizarre.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait until we get to the break because I want to talk with you about Ouija boards.
Sure.
But tell me about the Philip effect. What is that?
That is something that that is related to one of the Ouija board stories we might get to. And it is something that happens when people who share ideas about paranormal phenomena get together in some kind of a ritual setting, usually a seance. It's called the Philip effect because in 1972, the Toronto Society for Psychical Research decided to examine seance phenomena. And what they did was they designed their own ghost. They created a fake history, a fake name. They drew a portrait of him, and then they set out to contact his spirit. So they had the table, and they sat around it for like a seance, and they would call the Philip. They'd ask him questions, and they didn't get a lot of response until they began to have fun. They would do things like sing silly songs and eat candy and tell jokes, and eventually Philip started to answer. He would rap out answers to questions. The table began to move. But he never knew anything that hadn't existed in the story that they created for him.
Let's talk more about that when we come back. You know, this past weekend, I was at the Bay Area UFO Expo in Santa Clara near San Jose. Met a lot of people. We're going to have some new guests for you on Coast to Coast that many were at the conference. They just came to me, and I liked some of the things they were doing. But one of the things I'll do, I was approached by one of the managers of Roswell, New Mexico, and they'd love for me to do a complete program out there sometime in July. And I think I will. I think I'm going to move Coast to Coast up there for a program in Roswell, maybe even two shows. We'll find out, but that would be neat, and we'll bring some guests out there. Maybe Stanton Friedman will be out there, and we'll talk about what really happened at Roswell. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest Robert Schnuck tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We'll finish up with the Philip story, and then we'll talk about Ouija boards. Robert, let me let you finish up with the Philip effect story first before we move on.
Sure. Anyway, the members of the Toronto Society got regular, reliable paranormal phenomena on command. At least that's the way it seems to what they seem to have done. Like I said, it involved object movement. It involved intelligent answers wrapped out on the tabletop to questions. But all of these answers were within the story they had created for it, all of which suggests that this was not some kind of a spirit, this was not some kind of outside force, but something that the group itself was creating. It could be an example of group PK, group psychokinesis. And if what they described actually did happen, think about the repercussions of it in the power of prayer, in ritual magic. It suggests the possibility that groups working together can affect the physical world, which a lot of people have suggested over the years. Now, I have spoken to other people who have tried Philip-type experiments. The ghost's name was Philip. And some of them had some very spooky results. A lot of them got results right away. That is to say that the table actually not only moved, but sometimes levitated. And one, he wouldn't tell me what finally happened, but the responses they got were so violent that they simply stopped. And this was a group actually made up of college students, some of whom became well-known science fiction writers.
Okay, now to the Ouija board.
Yes.
On the appearance, it would seem that it's just a simple little game.
Right.
Is it?
It's sold by a toy company. It was, if you look at the box itself, the marketing is for children. Really, I mean, it's for adolescent girls. That's what the marketing is for, if you read it. Now, I don't see a Ouija board as the gateway drug to demonic possession the way a lot of people do.
Including me.
I don't see that. I think that sometimes people scare themselves half to death with the Ouija board. But I think the majority of what comes out of it is an expression of the subconscious of the people who are involved in it. That is not to say, however, that some very strange things have been reported in connection to Ouija boards. What they are is a divining tool. They are a method for... They were designed to facilitate communication with the spirit world.
Now, do you believe that, or do you think it's just a toy, a game?
No, I don't think it needs to be called a toy or a game. I think that what it is most of the time is an expression of the subconscious mind of the people taking part. I think some people shouldn't look too deeply into their subconscious mind, or they should be aware of that as a possible source, because very disturbing material can come out. And someone who is frightened, or someone who's easily frightened, or someone who becomes reliant on the board can actually do themselves damage. I mean, there are stories of people, for example, who develop friendships with what they believe is a spirit communicating through the board. And then the communications become violent, they become sexual, they become threatening, and suddenly what had seemed to be a very pleasant pastime becomes not so pleasant. Now, It can. Now, some people are going to look at that and say, this is demons. I look at it and say that there are parts of our mind that we're not really too familiar with, and that we can have a lot of anger, a lot of bizarre thoughts that we don't consciously acknowledge. Now, again, that is not to say that some very peculiar things have been reported with Ouija boards. I have heard stories of the planchette flying up into the air. I have heard stories of people getting information that they could not possibly have gotten through normal channels, and I don't pretend to know what the explanation for that is.
It literally shut down a broadcast studio when I had a Ouija board in the studio, Robert, a couple
of years
ago.
I remember that. I remember you telling that story on the air. You eventually threw it out the door, didn't you?
No, I gave it away, and I ruined that guy's life.
Yeah. Well, Ouija boards are, they've become a lightning rod for a lot of people. They're blamed for a lot of things, but I think we should bear in mind that millions of them are sold every year, and very little bad is said about
How
them.
How old are they?
Well, they were first developed sometime in the mid-19th century. They were, again, when spiritualism got started, they started out with something called table tilting, where the spirit, you could communicate with the spirit by the way it moved the table. Or if the spirit rapped, you would do things like lay out a board with letters on it, and you would run your fingers across the letters, and the spirit would rap when you came to the letter of the word it wanted to spell. Now, these were very time-consuming ways of communicating with the spirits, because you couldn't have an easy back and forth. There was a real bottleneck in the communication between this world and the spirit world, as the spiritualist interpreted it. So they developed a whole bunch of different kinds of things that led to Ouija boards. There was something called Pytho, which was like a pointer that would point to letters, and that worked pretty well. And there were others. But the Ouija board had two separate pieces, the planchette, the little board, the little plank, I think is what planchette literally means, and the board, which has the letters and the numbers. And the idea, of course, as most everybody knows, is that two people are supposed to put the board on their knees. The original boards were much bigger than the ones they sell now, and put their hands on the planchette, and it would start, and you'd ask it questions, and it would start to answer them. Yes, no, or spell out more elaborate answers. Now, the original attraction of the planchette was it was something that you could make very easily. You could, of the Ouija board, was it something you could make very easily? And when it began to be manufactured, it was very cheap. In fact, I call it the $1.50 miracle, because that's how much they sold it for. and a man named William Fold really turned it into a household name.
Fold?
Fold, F-U-L-D. Right. He claimed to have invented it, but he didn't. It had actually been invented years earlier by another man who unsuccessfully marketed it. But Fold knew what he was doing. He was a businessman, and he claimed to have invented it. He claimed a lot of things, and he put out the classic Ouija board. Now, Fold himself died a very strange death.
What happened to him?
He fell off the roof of his Ouija board factory.
Come on.
I am not making this up. In 1927, he was up on the roof of his Baltimore Ouija board factory supervising the installation of a flagpole. He was holding on to some kind of a metal support. The thing gave way, and he fell three stories down.
Man.
Yeah.
Tell me there's not something weird about a Ouija board now. When the creator...
Yeah, he That's fell off the roof of his Ouija board factory. In fact, his rib might have pierced his heart.
See, and I don't believe in coincidences, Robert. This is too weird.
It is a weird story, but it doesn't seem to have hurt sales. The Fold family kept putting out Ouija boards. They came up with all different kinds. And it's somewhere along the lines, I think Parker Brothers eventually bought them, and now they sell their own now all Ouija boards have a plastic planchette, and they glow in the dark, and they're much smaller than the originals, but they are still a big seller.
Have there been any direct violent murders or anything like that associated with Ouija boards?
Actually, there have been a few of them where Ouija boards were used as a defense, but my favorite was...
You mean in court?
Yeah, well, apparently the person claimed that the Ouija board had told them to do it. Whether it actually, you know, I'm sure their lawyer claimed that they would go for insanity or something like that. But of the stories I found, my favorite came from 1933, and it involved a man named Everett Turley, who was shot by his daughter, a teenage girl, I think she was about 15, named Maddie. Now, she claimed, this happened in Arizona, she claimed that she had been aiming at a skunk that was on the under the porch when she hit her father in the chest.
Nice shot, right?
He died a few days later. But after she was arrested, she changed her story, and she said that she had received direct orders from the Ouija board to kill her father, and that if she did it, she wouldn't get into any trouble. Now, she wasn't the medium herself. She wasn't the one using the board. It was her mother, Dorothea, who communicated all this to her and gave her all the spirit instructions. Now the police, of course, became interested because the source of the instructions to kill her father now came from the mother, or the spirits through the mother. And it turned out that there was a lot of insurance money on Everett Turley, and that Dorothea was very friendly with a local cowboy.
Uh-huh.
And so suddenly we're getting from the paranormal to movie of the week.
Yes, exactly. And of course she's the benefactor.
And she is the sole beneficiary of his will. Now, I must admit, I did enjoy this story. I guess I shouldn't enjoy it. I mean, the man died, but you spend all your time with such vague stuff about, you know, what did they see? When did they see it? What was involved? Is this paranormal? Is this psychological? It's nice to just get down to something that's sex and money.
I have only heard one positive story about Ouija boards. Just one in 5-6 years.
Really?
And this was a couple met because of a Ouija board, and their marriage is still going strong.
Oh, that's unusual.
How about you? Have you heard any?
The one that I like that I generally talk about is the story of Pearl Curran. And she was a housewife in St. Louis, Missouri. And in 1913, she was fooling with a Ouija board when she got a message from what claimed to be a spirit of somebody called Patience Worth. And Patience Worth was the spirit of an English girl who came to the United States and was killed by Indians in a massacre in the 17th century, somewhere in present-day Missouri. Now, Patience Worth seemed to have been a writer, because working through Pearl Curran, they began to produce an incredible amount of writing, novels, poems, short stories, even a play. They wrote so much that they actually published Patience Worth magazine for a year, because just to handle all the outflow, just to handle all that was coming out. Pearl Curran became famous as a writer. Patience Worth became very well known, and some of the novels did very well. They got good reviews.
People love this stuff.
Well, the stories themselves were good. Now, Pearl Curran had no previous experience as a writer, but this vast amount of literature was pouring out of her. Both Patience Worth and Pearl Curran have been almost forgotten. In fact, recently, we're not very far from the anniversary of her appearance, and I contacted the St. Louis Library to see if they were doing anything. No one even remembers her.
Look, I'm from St. Louis. I don't remember her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Well, now you see you've got a reason to go back and remind people to have Patience Worth Day at the library.
I will do just that for you, Robert.
Okay.
Oh, back to these positive stories about Ouija boards. I mean, mm-hmm. It's few and far between. You have to admit that.
They are few and far between. Most of the stories that people tell are the scary ones. I knew this one woman who had been fooling with a Ouija board when she was a teenage girl. They had been having a slumber party. And while they were fooling with the Ouija board, they heard what sounded like a rifle shot go off in the next room. Now, while they were fooling with the Ouija board, her friend I've had died in either a car accident or committed suicide. I really don't remember.
See, weird stuff.
But always a weird stuff. Now, she later claimed that he was writing through her because she began to experience fits of automatic writing where she would not be aware of what was happening, and then she'd find a note written to her about something.
Who would be giving her these messages?
Well, she felt it was the spirit of the boy that died that night.
Ah.
I don't know that that was it. I think it might have been more complicated than that. I think she may have had feelings for him, or she had some emotional relationship with him that his death left unresolved. And I think that she might have been trying to resolve it this way, that a part of her brain was trying to take care of this painful episode. But why it should start again 20 years after it had happened, I can't answer that.
What do you think causes that planchette to move, Robert?
I think most of the time, it is unconscious muscle movement. I have had this experience myself where I will, where I've used a pendulum, and I have said I am keeping this as absolutely straight as I possibly can. I am not going to move my hand. I am not going to.
It'll move.
And I will hold the pendulum, and I will think to myself, swing left to right.
Mm-hmm.
And it will.
Yep. I do the same thing. Yep. As a matter of fact, you can use that as a true or false questionnaire.
I've heard of people doing that.
Yeah.
And it is now I believe that what I am doing is unconsciously moving. I am moving those muscles. And I think that's a reasonable explanation for it. However, it could also be that something psychic is happening and we're still – it may still be unconscious muscular movement, but we could be having a psychic experience where they are getting information that they couldn't know, and it's being expressed through unconsciously moving around the planchette.
I'm going to ask you when we come back at the top of the hour to talk with us a little bit more about the Ouija board and the two monsters.
Oh, yeah.
That story. But how come you won't give us the names on the
Because air? Anyone who thinks of it, as long as you think of its name, it can hunt you down.
And you believe this?
I don't believe it, but...
Then give us the names later, Robert.
Because there are a lot of people who are obsessive thinkers. When they hear about something and they're told that as long as they think about it, they'll be in danger... they're going to keep thinking about it. And I don't know that I should do that to all of your listeners.
Oh, so you're protecting us.
I am protecting you.
What a good man you are.
Thank you.
Hey, tell me about the book. Where do you get it, The President's Vampire?
Okay. There's a link at Coast to Coast site. And you can go to anomalistbooks.com, anomalistbooks.com. And... click on their catalog, and you will find The President's Vampire, and, of course, Amazon.
Fascinating book.
And stop in at Anomalist, because they've got some excellent books that I know your readers will enjoy. They're some of my favorite titles.
Who did the graphics for the cover?
I designed it, and then a professional put together the actual images. He did a great job, didn't he?
Yeah, sure did. Stay with us. We'll be back. We'll talk a little bit more about these monsters. It'll be your turn as well. Your phone calls are next. You might want to share some Ouija board stories with us or simply talk with Robert about some of these very weird, strange things you've heard. Maybe he can back it up a little bit. We'll be back.